In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed.
Sherlock Holmes is arguably the most famous fictional detective of all time. The resident of 221B Baker Street has been the subject of countless films and television portrayals, remaining a figure of fascination around the globe. But what inspired Holmes's creator, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, to bring him into the world in the first place? John Borkum recently spoke to the author and biographer Andrew Lycett about the origins of the character and what the stories reveal about Doyle himself.
Firstly, Andrew, thanks for joining me on the History Extra podcast today.
Delighted to be here.
Now, Sherlock Holmes is undoubtedly one of the most famous fictional creations of all time. And as well as Arthur Conan Doyle's original stories, he's appeared in countless TV programmes, films, even video games. But to get us started, Andrew, I just wondered whether you could begin by telling us exactly when and how Sherlock Holmes was first introduced to the world.
Obviously, you can't remove Sherlock Holmes from his creator. That raises a whole kind of area that people like to get into. Was his creator Dr. John Watson, which is what some diehard Sherlockians like to say, or was he Arthur Conan Doyle? Now, for the purposes of this podcast, and generally speaking, as far as I'm always concerned, he was created by Arthur Conan Doyle. And, you know, there's a story behind that, which I will try to sort of elaborate on, which is that Conan Doyle was a highly educated man who trained as a doctor in Edinburgh, where he'd sort of imbued some of the sort of philosophy of that place, which was about sort of empirical inquiry, etc., etc. But he'd gone to be a GP in Southsea, on the south coast of England, close to Portsmouth. But he'd always wanted to write, and he'd begun to write, and he'd sort of tried to write various sort of genre things about the supernatural, etc., etc. Then in 1886, he got married, and he sort of calmed down a little bit, and he decided that he wanted to, as he put it, to get his name on the back of a volume, back of a book. So he wrote his first shortish Sherlock Holmes story, A Study in Scarlet, which was not immediately taken up, but eventually it was published in Beaton's Christmas Annual. And it made a few waves, and Conan Doyle was then still a GP, but he was trying to sort of develop his career as a writer. He went up to London, sort of met a few writers. He was invited by an American publisher to a famous dinner at the Langham Hotel, where the American publisher called Lipcott. And the other person there, well, one of the other people there was Oscar Wilde. These two writers were asked to go away and write stories for the magazine. Oscar Wilde went away and wrote his study of Dorian Gray, whereas Conan Doyle went and wrote the second of the Sherlock Holmes stories, which was The Sign of Four. That was duly published in the magazine, and it sort of created a bit more of a noise about Conan Doyle. He decided that he was going to move from the South Coast and move up to London, but initially he was still going to continue as a doctor, continue the sort of dual career as a doctor, and try and develop his career as a writer. By good chance, he got himself an agent for a start, and then by good chance there was a new magazine which just appeared called Strand Magazine, which was sort of catering for the sort of newly educated middle class, let's put it like that, people who were sort of commuting and stuff, and, you know, wanted a shortish read to read in the train, take back home to read with a family. And this magazine, Strand Magazine, decided that Sherlock Holmes offered a sort of good story to develop over a number of issues. Now, it wasn't going to be a serial like had been the norm in sort of magazines. It wasn't going to be like Dickens and sort of you had to have a cliffhanger or that kind of thing. This was going to be a series of separate stories, which obviously, you know, introduce Sherlock Holmes and his sidekick, Dr. Watson. And, you know, it was the adventures of Sherlock Holmes as told in these what became monthly stories in Strand Magazine, as told by Dr. John Watson.
Fantastic. That's an excellent summary there. When did Arthur Conan Doyle then think, hey, I can make this into a full-time career?
Very quickly. You know, he started writing these stories in at the beginning of 1891. And by the middle of that year, he decided, I mean, they were already creating waves, if you want to put it that way. And he was able to say, you know, knock his medical career on its head and say, I'm going to devote myself full time to writing. Now, at the same time, he wasn't totally committed to Sherlock Holmes. He was writing other things. He wanted to write, you know, he really saw himself as a sort of writer of historical novels. And he'd just published a novel about the Hundred Years' War called The White Company. And so, you know, he was doing this parallel. But obviously the success of Sherlock Holmes, well, it encouraged him to stop working as a doctor and to devote himself full-time to writing. By then he had two children, and he decided pretty quickly that he was going to move from where he was initially in London, which was sort of Wimpole Street area, sort of close to doctors in Harley Street, etc., etc. And he moved down to his first sort of proper home, which was in South Norwood, suburb of in South London, if you like.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Fascinating. And to what extent was the character of Sherlock Holmes modelled on Doyle's old mentor from back in Edinburgh, Dr. Joseph Bell?
One of the things that Conan Doyle learnt at Edinburgh was, you know, there was a sort of strong tradition of empirical inquiry at the university, at the sort of centre of David Hume and et cetera, et cetera. And there was a number of famous medics who'd been through the Edinburgh Medical School and taught there. But Conan Doyle, who was studying medicine, he had a number of teachers who sort of were very influential. But perhaps the most important was this character called Dr. Joseph Bell, who was a professor of surgery. He somehow saw something in Conan Doyle, it seems, because he chose him to sort of work with him in the Edinburgh Royal Infirmary. And Conan Doyle used to go round with Dr. Joseph Bell and sort of imbibe the business of examining patients. And Bell had a very specific technique. I mean, he was very observant. He could look at somebody coming in from, I don't know, from the Highlands, and, you know, he could say exactly what that person had been doing that day by looking at his shoes and sort of say that he walked here by, and he, you know, say that because of the kind of boots that he had probably worked in the military or something like that. And Conan Doyle took this on board. It was really about the kind of importance of observing closely. And as he later said to Watson, you know, you have something like, you have looked, but you haven't observed. You have to take everything in. And this was the important thing as far as, first of all, Joseph Bell, Dr. Joseph Bell at Edinburgh University, and then later Conan Doyle, and later, obviously, Sherlock Holmes put across.
Indeed. And now, Andrew, this book of yours is called The Worlds of Sherlock Holmes. And if we want to talk about setting, then, of course, we have to talk about 221B Baker Street, probably the most famous fictional address of all time. What would the real Baker Street have looked like around the time that Doyle was writing these stories?
Well, it was... Okay, there was Baker Street, which sort of basically grew out of Oxford Street and sort of the West End. And then it sort of went across the Marylebone Road. I think it was then still called the New Road. And it sort of became Upper Baker Street and went up to the suburbs, to St. John's Wood and then further afield. So it was sort of an interesting sort of gentrified arterial road that really took traffic northwards from the West End. But it was also interesting in that it was close to the railway lines that were coming into London at the time. So, you know, it was particularly close to Marylebone Station and also not too far from other stations, sort of which straddled now the Marylebone and Euston Road, so Euston and King's Cross. But also that axis, if you like to call it that, was where the Underground Railway had recently been introduced. So Baker Street found itself on the new Underground Railway, Metropolitan Line, which was quickly extended out into the suburbs. And, you know, you have instances in the stories of people coming to see Sherlock Holmes and using the Underground Railway to do so.
And looking beyond Baker Street to London and Britain itself, the country was undergoing quite a radical transformation at the time, not just in terms of things like transport and technology, but there was also a sense that its place in the world was changing. Do we get a glimpse of that in Arthur Conan Doyle's writing?
We certainly get a glimpse of it, and it's quite interesting to sort of tease out exactly how it occurs and where. You know, you can't get away from the fact that it was a time of great change, and actually in the real world, even in 1895, you know, things were changing, that the British Empire was at its zenith, but it was also beginning to feel that it didn't quite have the primacy, and there was, you know, it was very much the period of imperial rivalry and Germany in particular beginning to encroach on British supremacy, if you like. And this was carried on into the Boer War. Now, here you begin to get that sort of parallel lives of Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle, because Conan Doyle had his own particular take on all this. You know, he was born in Edinburgh and of Irish extraction. Both his families were Irish, but he came down to live in England and sort of adopted the English way of life. And But his experience, actually, I mean, as a young boy, he'd been to Ireland and he'd been disturbed by Fenian violence. And that was a thing of the late 19th century in London, that you get sort of incidents, bombings, etc., blamed on the Fenians. So Conan Doyle became very much sort of conservative in his political views. He was a liberal unionist, and liberal unionist actually meant conservative. It was a conservative with liberal tendencies who kind of believed in the union of Ireland. Now, Ireland plays quite a significant role in the Sherlock Holmes stories. You have people who might be described as Fenians introduced into the stories, creating a sense of violence, etc. So Conan Doyle was for stability, if you like to put it that way. He became an imperialist, and he became a great proponent of empire, which plays its part in the Sherlock Holmes stories. It's not a theme that is pushed, but nevertheless, it is there. But perhaps the theme that is particularly stressed in the stories is that Conan Doyle, particularly, and through his character Sherlock Holmes, is a great advocate of sort of closeness between Britain and the United States.
And now, Andrew, you have alluded to it earlier on, but the Victorian era was an age of scientific empiricism. And as I think you point out in the book, Doyle himself was born in the same year that Darwin published On the Origin of Species. Is the character of Sherlock Holmes then a conscious reflection of that kind of thinking?
Sherlock Holmes is definitely a reflection of that, what's going on in the world. To what extent was he actually a conscious reflection of it? I think he was, because Conan Doyle was sort of trying to say something interesting about the world around him. But it was really a reflection of Conan Doyle's own upbringing. And I've tried to explain a bit about that, you know, the background that he'd had. So, you know, he had been brought up to observe closely in his training as a doctor, and he introduced that into Sherlock Holmes. Conan Doyle was very much a man of his times. He was a bit of an adventurer. You know, he liked to travel. He'd worked as a doctor on a whaling ship in the Arctic. He'd traveled as a doctor on a trading ship that went down the West African coast. And, you know, he'd sort of been introduced to various countries along the route when it sort of docked. And, you know, he liked to travel widely. So, you know, the sense of the world was there in the Sherlock Holmes stories.
And how does that tally with the author's own personal beliefs? Because if there's one thing that people know about Arthur Conan Doyle, aside from Sherlock Holmes, it's often that he became very fascinated with spiritualism later in life. How do you reconcile that rational thinking and this belief in, you know, this obsession with ghosts and things that can't be proved by science?
Good question. And, you know, I'm glad that you asked that, because, you know, that is crucial to both, well, particularly to Conan Doyle, I guess, and sort of to Sherlock Holmes. Basically, Conan Doyle decided that Sherlock Holmes would be the representation of his view of the scientific world. And, you know, he didn't introduce any sense of the supernatural really into the Sherlock Holmes stories. I mean, there was no kind of supernatural things that Sherlock Holmes adopted to solve his cases. And if in a late story he talks about, you know, no ghosts need apply to, you know, vacancy, you know, in any kind of element of his thinking or endeavors. Now, Conan Doyle, he personally, and he was greatly believed in the scientific method, but he retained a sort of sense that there was something a bit more in the world than could be just explained by science. Consequently, you know, in sort of almost in parentheses, you know, he was not a supporter, he was not an advocate of the sort of mechanistic view of the mind, which was beginning to come to the surface through the works of Sigmund Freud, and etc. Conan Doyle had a much more sort of spiritual idea of how the mind worked. And it was partly to do with, you know, the fact that he was brought up in not exactly a religious environment, but I guess you could call it that. I mean, he was basically a Catholic, and he could never, you know, although he at university, he began to call himself an agnostic, he could never quite throw off the sort of influence of his upbringing. So he had a curious sort of relationship between science and religion, which he explores in various non-Sherlockian works, you know, that there's sort of more autobiographical works that he, one or two that he came up with. And so there is that tension. And actually, my feeling is that this tension between the sort of science of Conan Doyle, which he gives to his scientifically trained or scientifically orientated consulting detective, there's a tension between that and Conan Doyle's own sense that there is something else. And that actually makes for an interesting dimension to the Sherlock Holmes stories, which, you know, if you take it a bit further, perhaps explains to a certain extent, you know, why they've endured.
Exactly. And you mentioned his non-Sherlockian works there. Was Arthur Conan Doyle ever frustrated that Holmes perhaps overshadowed his other writings? So Professor Challenger, for instance.
Yes, Conan Doyle was definitely frustrated by, you know, the sense that he wanted to do something else. He wanted to do something a bit more, you know, he admired the historical novels of Walter Scott and Robert Louis Stevenson. He wanted to emulate them. That was where he saw his forte. Well, not necessarily, obviously it wasn't really his forte, but it was where he really wanted to be remembered as a historical novelist. And, you know, he wrote about, for example, the Napoleonic Wars in the Brigadier Gerard stories. So, you know, Sherlock Holmes was a kind of interruption. It was a welcome interruption. He wanted to, you know, make money. He liked that. He enjoyed having money and became obviously very rich, and et cetera, et cetera. But obviously, you know, as is well known, he tried to kill off Sherlock Holmes after something like 24 stories. And he wanted to concentrate on other things. He was sort of dragged back into writing Sherlock Holmes, partly because of, you know, financial necessities, because as I say, he was quite rich, but, you know, he was just made an offer that he couldn't refuse. You know, an American publisher wanted him to come back and write new Sherlock Holmes stories in the early 20th century, and he gave it another go.
And now, Andrew, let's talk about Sherlock Holmes' journey from the printed page into other forms of media. Firstly, when did he make his way into the theatre?
Well, pretty early on. For some reason, although film was around, and Conan Doyle being sort of advocate of modern things. He liked gadgets and stuff. And he, you know, he was very into photography. That was one of his early hobbies. Somehow or other, Sherlock Holmes was kind of bypassed by certainly British and American filmmakers initially. But he was taken up by an American actor-producer called William Gillette in around the sort of end of the sort of about 1900. And, you know, Gillette took Sherlock Holmes onto the stage in both New York and then later in London and made him a great success. And he introduced some of the sort of accoutrements that you now find associated with Sherlock Holmes, which are not necessarily in the original stories. So the merchant-bound pipe and, you know, hooked pipe, etc. The hat that he wore. So these sort of, you know, the visual side of Sherlock Holmes began to develop through this very popular play that, as I say, ran in New York and in London. starring this chap, William Gillette. So it was late, you know, only subsequently that Sherlock Holmes was taken up by filmmakers, but they sort of adopted what had by then become a kind of visual cliche for the character.
Sure. And there was quite a convoluted process in getting Sherlock Holmes onto the big screen, wasn't there? Can you just talk us through that?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, you know, it took a little while for Sherlock Holmes to reach the big screen, if you like. Strangely, some of his first representations on the screen were in Denmark and in Germany, where they seemed to, you know, sort of there was a strong tradition of the silent screen. Then there was a sort of ersatz Sherlock Holmes character that was introduced in France, and Conan Doyle got a bit fed up with that, and he tried to stop it. He hadn't really taken much interest in film. And after that, he was more open to film representations of Sherlock Holmes. You began to get them during the First World War. And then he was taken up by an important British company, the Stoll Film Company, that sort of reproduced a number of Sherlock Holmes films. And then, you know, then you got Hollywood taking him up, and, you know, you've got eventually the sort of famous representations of Sherlock Holmes starring Basil Rathbone and people like that. So it was an ongoing process, if you like, and there was various sort of developments in it. You know, at certain stages, there's always the sort of Conan Doyle estate, which passed into his son's hands after Conan Doyle himself died in 1930, so quite sort of early on, and if you like, in the film's history. And then at various stages, the estate was cooperating with certain filmmakers, etc., and then, you know, not. And, you know, so a history developed of Sherlock Holmes on the screen.
Yes, and as you mentioned there, I think when most of us think of the original Sherlock Holmes, we think of, yeah, Basil Rathbone in Hound of the Baskervilles, for instance. I mean, but what adaptations do you feel most accurately capture the essence of the original Holmes?
Funny enough, I can't really think of anything that really captures the essence of Sherlock Holmes. And, you know, I honestly feel that is something that is still to be done. I mean, the latest manifestation of Sherlock Holmes, as far as people are concerned, is Benedict Cumberbatch television series. But it, you know, it's, although it interestingly kind of references a lot of the stories, it's so keen on being sort of clever and tricksy that it misses the steady pace of the original Sherlock Holmes stories. It's difficult, really. I mean, a lot of films, you will discover, are sort of amalgamations of, say, three stories, and, you know, a filmmaker's put together three stories, because, you know, you can't just necessarily film something that is written in 6,000 words or something like that. You know, you need more of a body of work. So, you know, perhaps the greatest films are, you know, the greatest film, Sherlock Holmes film, and the one that has been actually people go back to more than ever is The Hound of the Baskervilles, which you mentioned. So, you know, that gives you something to kind of get your teeth into, if you like. You know, it has different sort of elements. You know, starts off in London, then you've got the countryside. You've got that tension between science and the supernatural, which it's not manifest in all the stories by any means. And, you know, you've got a very strong framework of a story, even though it doesn't, certainly in the written story, it doesn't actually involve Sherlock Holmes himself until sort of at least halfway through the story.
And finally, Andrew, the big question, why do you think the world is still so captivated by Sherlock Holmes?
I think the world is captivated by Sherlock Holmes because he is a strong character, but nevertheless delightfully ambivalent in some ways. You know, what kind of a man was Sherlock Holmes? You know, he was this great rationalist, but, you know, he sort of went home and sort of was back to Baker Street, and he played his violin. So he wasn't a total stoic or whatever. But more than that, you know, he liked to relax by ingesting a solution of cocaine. And, you know, in a way, that makes him very contemporary. But to go back to your question about, you know, why is Sherlock Holmes so popular, if you like? It is the tension between these various aspects of him. You know, he's difficult to pin down exactly. He's a pleasant character. He's not a difficult character. You know, people like him. They like that relationship between him and Dr. Watson, you know, which, you know, has, if you like, sort of different sides of a relationship, if you like, of different characters. And it's been taken up by other detective writers, if you like. It comes in the Morse stories or whatever. Sherlock Holmes, he's very adaptable. I mean, this is something that I learned from reading something that the writer John le Carré said about him, because he introduced a volume of Conan Doyle stories. And he'd said that, you know, one of the features of the Sherlock Holmes stories is that the mixture of dialogue and description is very important to the development of the stories. And, you know, that is very true. But he also, le Carré, made the point that that makes them very easy to adapt to other languages. And one of the features of Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, is that he has been widely translated. He is popular in other cultures. He's very popular in Japan, for example, and there's Japanese films, Japanese television series featuring Sherlock Holmes, you know, just as much as there is in Hollywood.
That was Andrew Lycett. His new book, The Worlds of Sherlock Holmes, The Inspiration Behind the World's Greatest Detective, is out now.
Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley. Thank you.